ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is my trusty co-host, Mr. Chad Riley.
I'm here.
He is here, ladies and gentlemen. You can calm down. He will be here for the full show. He's not going to cut out like Kanye West. He will be here.
Though I might rant for a while.
He may rant. That's part of his job here. We're just to forewarn you, but, you know, he's going to stick around.
Hopefully.
Yes. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a great show in store for you today, and we're going to be talking about one of Disney's up-and-coming animated films. Not CGI, animated, so Pixar isn't in the point. But
It's still CGI.
It's
not Pixar.
It's not Pixar. And that is, of course, Moana, and we'll talk about that film. We got a chance to see it, and we're going to have a good time.
Very good.
The Filmlosophers is presented by Mingle Media TV and recorded in a colorful conch shell at VGB Studios in Sacramento, California. Oi, Chad. If this is your first time listening to the podcast, you're in for a treat. Don't let that stop you from downloading other great content. You can subscribe to The Filmlosophers and peruse our catalog of episodes on your favorite platforms, including Google Play, Stitcher, Audio Boom, Player FM, Libsyn, and iTunes. Filmlosophers fans, we love connecting with you on social media. To share your thoughts on recent movie news and our latest episodes, simply like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. Finally, check out vgbstudios.com for our entire library of episodes, as well as other great podcasts such as Video Game Bang and Me, Mike Self, and I.
So much good content to listen to on that website, really.
Especially when it's all ours.
I mean, if you're home for the holidays and just need something to do.
Oh, yeah. Actually, that's a great idea.
So much stuff to listen to.
But, of course, you know, before we get into anything else, we, of course, have to hit the movie news.
Do we have to?
Well,
can we just sort of, like, run alongside it? We don't have to hit it.
But, you know, it's better to hit it because then we hit it and we can just lay it out.
Okay.
So,
if you say so, you're the boss.
At the top of the movie news tonight, it looks like Highlander might be getting the John Wick treatment. So, The Hollywood Reporter is saying that John Wick co-director Chad Stahelski,
good name,
who also directed John Wick 2, or is planning to direct John Wick 2, is on board to direct a Highlander remake. John Wick 2 hasn't come out yet.
It's pretty much done.
Oh, it's already in the books?
It's not in the theaters yet, but it's pretty much done.
The project is far enough along that a search for a new group of writers has begun to work with Stahelski and his crew on the reboot. He's been stated as saying, "I've been a huge fan of the original property since I saw it in high school. Such great themes of immortality, love, and identity are all wrapped up in such colorful mythology. I can't think of a better property that gives the opportunity to create interesting characters, mythic themes, and action set pieces." Kind of got messed up a bit.
Interesting, though. I want to see how, because John Wick was his directorial debut. He was a co-director on that one, and then he has gone on to be a solo director for John Wick 2.
Yeah.
So I wonder how the, you know, just the pacing and the camera angles and the kinetic kind of activity within the frame, how all of that is going to maybe change the appearance and the flow of the Highlander franchise.
It's true, because if you look at the career of both the co-directors, Chad Stahelski and the other individual, I'm sorry, but his name escapes me. He's also the guy who is slated to direct the new Deadpool film. But before they even started directing, they were both stuntmen. So they both knew the ins and outs of how to kind of gauge how a shot should be done as far as from a stuntman's point of view, because you're the one who's obviously doing all the flips and the jumps and all these kinds of things. So for John Wick, the first film, I mean, it worked out exceptionally well. I was personally a huge fan of the first John Wick film, and because it was one of the few films that Keanu Reeves was a part of that he didn't really talk all that much. And that
you gotta use people in the best way.
Exactly. And in the one point that he did talk, I was like, you broke the magic. But to see that type of action and that type of kinetic energy in a film, to have that and to try to put that in a property that you know is nothing but nonstop action and sword fighting and there can only be one, all that kind of stuff, Sean Connery and all that.
Well, I mean, you've got, whenever you're talking about somebody who's a stunt person or a professional athlete or somebody who uses their body to physically, you know, do something repeatedly. I mean, you got that muscle memory. You've got that physicality just to within the frame. I mean, that's your entire job, is to make it look good, you know, with fist fights or car stunts or, you know, wire work or whatever you're doing. So it'll be interesting to see how that translates into Highlander, which to me, Highlander has always sort of erred more on the side of philosophical than actual stunt work. I mean, yeah, they've got swords and they fight and, you know, but it will be interesting to see how intricately they do the stunt work and how much of a focus the stunt work has in the film, given his background in particular.
That's true. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a Highlander scene for scene type of film. It can be an inspired type film. I mean, obviously, they're going to go with the same title, Highlander. But if you take a look at films like The One with Jet Li, Jason Statham, that's a similar type film. I mean, pretty much it's the same film, just with martial arts.
Right, exactly.
And Jason Statham. So I could see maybe they could turn the film a bit more where there's not so much as the usage of the iconic sword, but maybe I don't know. I could see more guns being placed into this type of, you know, film. I could see them doing something unique.
Well, I mean, it depends on when they choose to set the story, really, because the whole premise of Highlander is that he keeps getting resurrected or keeps coming back to life, or I don't remember the exact mechanism by which he continues, or no, it passes on.
Yeah.
Somebody defeats him and becomes the next Highlander, isn't it that way?
Yeah.
So depending on when they set the story, I mean, it would be interesting, for example, if they set it, I don't know, in the midst of World War II. And how does that have a different feel than the more medieval style backdrop that, you know, that you're used to? Although it did have the TV series that ran in the 90s that's
true.
Kind of experimented a little bit with that, I think. I never watched it, but...
Neither did I. I just remember the movie, but... You know, we'll keep our ears to the ground, and who knows? This could turn into a really big, another really big blockbuster for Chad Stahelski.
Again, great name.
And it could, I mean, after the success of John Wick, the first one, a lot of people kind of underestimating the film because of the no-name directors. I mean, you put to anybody else other than director in the director's chair, and all of a sudden the quality of the film in everyone else's mind just suddenly drops. And then you have them offer something like this, and people will, you know, start second guessing. Well, okay, that was a really good film. What else can they do? And, you know.
Well, you also had the surprise factor of Keanu Reeves. You know, what I don't remember the name of the film that he fronted before John Wick. It was the one with the Dragon Lady. What was it called? Anyway,
CGI
that was
film. Something Samurai.
I mean, it was like supposed to be really big, and then nobody really liked it, and it didn't really go anywhere, and it was basically all driven by his star power, and there wasn't a lot of torque in that drive system. But so with John Wick, people kind of initially thought, oh man, he's back in the front seat, how much can his star power drive the movie? And that isn't what drove the movie, actually. It was the action pieces.
It was the
experience of the film that got people talking and inviting their friends to go see it.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully they can carry that over, because that's not star power that did that. That is creative decisions
and
by the executives and the directors.
And not having to hear him say, whoa.
True.
So, but moving forward, Angela Bassett boards Marvel's Black Panther film in a key role. So, obviously, and I don't know why I keep saying it over and over again when this should be common knowledge, but we're Marvel fans here. We're fans of any property that has great storytelling, and so far Marvel is hitting the mark every time.
So far, so
and,
good.
And with the inclusion of Black Panther into the whole MCU, it adds a whole another layer to the already huge storyboard that they have going for the MCU. And now, with a ton of other names, they've brought on board Angela Bassett as well. And she has been casted to play T'Challa's mother, which is named Ramonda. I'm hoping...
Ramonda. T'Challa being the given name of the superhero we know as the Black Panther.
Yes.
He was in Captain America Civil War.
Now, as far as... Because in terms of this room right here, you are the Marvel expert. I am putting that on you. That is your cross to bear.
All right. I'll do my best.
As far as... In regards to canon and what's canon, what isn't, is Ramonda in the comics? Is there any iteration of her?
Yeah, I mean, she's usually with the Black Panther, and the Black Panther is not one of the titles that I am most familiar with. I grew up with the X-Men, so ask me any X-Men question. I can, you know, at least be in the right ballpark of an answer. The other ones to smaller degrees. Black Panther, I've only read a few issues here and there. Typically, his stories have a lot of father-son connections because Black Panther is not a role that is unique to T'Challa. It's a role that's passed down from one leader of their civilization in Wakanda, the king, to the next king. And the previous king's spirit goes to the necropolis, which is their... essentially the land of the dead. And so the Black Panther, the current living king, is a go-between between the lands of the living and the dead. So oftentimes you have T'Challa, Black Panther, speaking with his father, T'Chaka, former Black Panther, and other former Wakandans in the necropolis. And typically the dynamic in the Black Panther series has been largely a paternal rather than maternal dynamic. So I'm sure that the mother, Ramonda, does appear in several different storylines. To what capacity, I'm not sure.
Yeah, and I think that was what I was driving to as far as does her role in the comics, because this is what the Hollywood Reporter but most outlets are reporting it as a key role, and I'm trying to see, does she play a key role in the comics? And you actually may hit on something as far as we already know that T'Chaka has passed due to the bombing that occurred from Baron Zemo. So switching that role over to a motherly role as far as she being the one possibly, you know, giving guidance or some sort. I had no idea. It gets that deep into, like, just like how with the Asgardians and how, you know, it goes to, like, their form of Hades or their form of hell and all that kind of stuff. And I didn't know that the... Black Panther storyline delved that deep into creating a mythology for the storyline.
Oh, sure, yeah. It's a very rich story. The thing with Wakanda, which is the fictional African nation that Black Panther and his parents and all of them are from, it's a made-up nation, and so they have a complete, very rich history and mythology and role. They're very technologically advanced. They have been separatist basically from the entire world for multiple generations by the time T'Challa takes over as king of Wakanda and the Black Panther. And so and we kind of saw reflections of that in Captain America Civil War, where T'Chaka, before his unfortunate demise, T'Chaka is kind of saying to the gathered forces of the UN, you know, it's time for us to come out of hiding, to stop being separatist, and to start influencing the world in a positive way again, you know, more officially, and not being such an isolationist country up here in the, you know, mountains, you know, in Africa, where we can kind of segment ourselves off and not participate if we don't want to. And so in the comics, they have that same technologically rich, very advanced civilization, very scientifically advanced beyond most other nations on the earth. But that's kind of something that needs to be revealed over time because they've been so set apart for so long. I did pull up a little wiki on Ramonda, and this says that she's actually the surrogate mother of T'Challa, and the birth mother of Princess Shuri, who is his younger half-sister, who ends up at one point in the comics, she takes on the role of Black Panther.
Oh, wow.
And becomes the Black Panther and the leader of the nation of Wakanda. I believe that he's now in charge again, but she led for quite a ways as well. So in the comics, it looks like Ramonda was the surrogate mother, but was not the queen. And so after a series of events, it looks like T'Challa reinstated her deemed her queen mother. So
gotcha.
Queen mother being the mother of the sitting monarch.
Well, in addition to Chadwick Boseman, who plays the titular Black Panther, and of course Angela Bassett, the film also has lined up Michael B. Jordan as the villainous Killmonger, Lupita Nyong'o as the Wakandan warrior Nakia?
Yeah, she's one of the personal bodyguards, I believe.
Okay.
Oh, goodness, what is their name? They have a name. They're really cool.
They were the ones who were kind of briefly mentioned in the special...
they have a
edited
name.
Scenes in the...
I am kicking myself. I'm going to kick myself when I see what it is. But, yeah, essentially, the Black Panther, whoever the king is, or the queen, they have a personal bodyguard.
Ah.
And they're... these very advanced Dora Milaje. Dora Milaje are these women who typically they have bald heads and they're extremely competent warriors. You do not mess with them. As much as you wouldn't want to mess with the Black Panther, you would not want to mess with the Dora Milaje.
Also on the docket, you got Andy Serkis as Age of Ultron's low-tier baddie, Ulysses Klaue. And Winston Duke as a key villain, M'Baka, a character known to fans of the comic series as Manape. That's a really weird, interesting villainous name.
It'll be interesting to see how they translate him, because in the comics, if I remember correctly, he is an ape who is smarter than most men.
Seriously?
Yes. He is an advanced ape. Kind of like Planet of the Apes in a way, I remember correctly. So
like, similar like a Gorilla Grodd type.
Yes, very similar.
Okay.
Very similar. If I, or maybe I'm picturing Gorilla Grodd and just pretending like I'm thinking of Manape. I don't really know. Again, it's not my forte.
Well, as news continues to roll out, we'll of course keep you up to date. But that does bring us to our special presentation that we have today. Where? Man, this music is just... gets you going.
Like stopped you in your tracks.
It did. Ladies and gentlemen, we are going to be reviewing today for you Disney's Moana.
Yep, out today, actually.
Yeah, when you hear this, when you'll be listening to the review, it'll be out today, which is Wednesday. God willing, if you watch it Wednesday, or you listen to us on Wednesday. Or...
all these details that listeners don't really...
yeah. Of course, they're in our minds.
So you might be listening to this several weeks after we've recorded, and therefore you've seen the movie, and you can just let us know on social how you feel about our review.
Just true. But of course, Disney's Moana, an adventurous teenager who sails out on a daring mission to save her people. During her journey, Moana meets the once mighty demigod, Maui, who guides her in her quest to become a master wayfinder. Together, they sail across the open ocean on an action-packed voyage, encountering enormous monsters and impossible odds. Along the way, Moana fulfills the ancient quest of her ancestors and discovers the one thing she always sought, her own identity. That's a lot.
That's
pretty accurate.
Really, there you go. That's the movie in a nutshell. Our job is done, people. Thank you and good night.
Pretty much. I was like, is there anything else? No. Produced by Walt Disney Animation Studios, the film stars Ali'i Cravalho as Moana, alongside Dwayne The Rock Johnson as Maui. This is the second film from Disney Animation Studios this year, following March's release of Zootopia. Moana boasts an opportunity to celebrate Polynesian culture by implementing many of their customs and art throughout the film. And it definitely does. This film is one of those types of it's almost like a love story to the culture of the islanders, because I don't think it's just Polynesian. I feel like it really resonates with just pretty much any islander, you know?
Well, I mean, it's meant to have this kind of the embodiment of that exploratory spirit.
Yeah.
That that led to the colonization of so many of these islands.
Yeah.
In the Pacific.
So, like we said, this was the second film. Another great addition to this film was the musical talents of Broadway's Lin-Manuel Miranda. Miranda wrote several songs for the film, as well as lending his vocal talents. You can really get a glimpse of the mindset of Miranda throughout a lot of the songs that you hear throughout the film, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But he's definitely there. You can't miss his voice, because he has a very unique voice. I have to admit, like, it's almost storytelling-ish.
Yeah, so if any of you who are listening don't know from the name dropping who Lin-Manuel Miranda is, he's the lyricist, visionary main star of the Broadway show Hamilton, that won a billion awards and has a ton of acclaim, critics and audiences alike. So he now is doing other things other than the Broadway show. Did another one before Hamilton too. In the Heights, maybe?
Yes.
Anyway, very, very, very modern musical style. It's a blend of kind of the pacing and the rhythm of hip hop music, but then also has those big notes that you expect from, you know, a Broadway show tune, and the musical style of the songs that have lyrics in Moana definitely borrow from that style, and so it feels very distinctively Lin-Manuel Miranda, if you've ever heard his work.
Yeah, and a quick side note about Miranda as well. It was In the Heights that you were talking about as far as his work.
I thought so, yeah.
But also, too, it seems like Disney has really struck a lightning in a bottle opportunity with Lin-Manuel Miranda to pretty much have him on to star in the upcoming Mary Poppins sequel. As well as him working and producing and co-composing with Alan Menken for Disney's upcoming Little Mermaid live-action film. Not to mention, Alan Menken. Miranda also has a upcoming film in the works with Disney in regards to this secret project that he's going to co-create with, I believe it's Brad Bird.
Okay, yeah, one of the, long-established Pixar directors.
Yeah.
One of the brain trust of Pixar guys.
So, Moana. First impressions, Chad.
Eddie.
Sure.
First impressions, it was a very competent Disney film. Mm-hmm. Very colorful, really enjoyable. There wasn't anything that I would say was particularly out of the ordinary in a technical standpoint. There wasn't anything about the animation that was, you know, I've never seen that before. They had a lot of moments that were good standout moments for mm-hmm. the characters, especially for the culture. I like what they did with some of the visionary sequences, almost like a dream sequence, but really a little bit more, a little different than a dream sequence. It had strong characterization for Moana herself. Mm-hmm. Maui less so, but he doesn't really need much more than the superficial bits that you see. He has a little bit of a deeper story, but nothing too ridiculously overtold.
Yeah.
In the film. It was very enjoyable, very colorful, inventive, creative. It gave a window into a mythological story series that most people will not be familiar with, mm-hmm. Which I found very refreshing. And in its own way, in some small ways, I really liked how some of what they did harkened back to Hercules, which is an older Disney animated film that also has a strong mythological bent to it. And so they make some common stylistic choices.
Yeah, and I agree with pretty much all of that. As far as the film is concerned, it didn't really do anything outside of the Disney formula for most of their animated features. You have a similar structure. What set it apart for me was the Disney's ability to incorporate a lot of the Polynesian culture, a lot of that islander culture that they were able to just put in song, in art, in even the way the characters looked. It wasn't by happen chance that they just made these characters look like this. There's a distinct characteristic physically for most islander individuals, and they hit it on the mark when they made the characters as they did in the film. And I have to commend.
Yeah, well,
Disney
and the
on
clothing that they're wearing,
with the
and
clothing.
The tattooing of different, yes, you know, scenes and sequences and whatnot, and all of it. It had a very well researched,
oh yeah,
authentic kind of feel.
Yeah, so it was a good film, and like I said, we'll get into a little bit more about it. But overall, it didn't break the formula for me. But overall, it was good. So right from the get-go, we are introduced to the inciting incident, if you will, for the overall film. The incident that pretty much jettisons Moana to do what she ends up doing, which is the grandmother telling the story of Maui and him stealing something. And the film is pretty much one of those films where somebody did something wrong, it hasn't been fixed, it has to be fixed, somebody is chosen to be the one to fix it, they go get the person to help them fix it, that person's a butt, and yeah.
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, it follows the pretty well-documented mythological story structure Joseph mm-hmm. Campbell kind of made popular with the hero with a thousand faces mm-hmm. back in the, what, 50s, 60s. And a lot of Hollywood followed for 80s, 90s. You know, after George Lucas kind of picked it up with Star Wars, they really wanted to tell these mythologically structured stories that a lot of, you know, a lot of different cultures, if you follow the key folklore within their own mythological sequences, a lot of them follow a similar pattern where you have a chosen hero who may be reluctant to do what they wanted, they're selected to do. They have to leave the culture that they're used to in order to solve a problem. They descend into the underworld. They obtain some sort of elixir
literally,
of life.
Literally.
And they return. They either succeed or fail in returning and restoring their culture. And in many ways, Moana follows that almost to a T, and doesn't make any bones about it. I mean, the very beginning of the movie sets up a mythological sequence where you're introduced to what happened 1,000 years in the past that has now created this situation for Moana mm-hmm. to solve.
True, and so right from the get-go, we're introduced to some key characters that are important to Moana's overall story, because once we're introduced to Moana, Moana's at a very young age. But we're introduced to her grandmother and her father, who is the chief of the village that they live in on the island. And as well, we're introduced to Moana's mother. But the key dynamic there is mainly the relationship that she has with her father, who, is played by Temuera Morrison, which I haven't the slightest clue who he is, but he is a New Zealand actor.
Yeah, he's from New Zealand. He's been in a million things. He was Jango Fett in the Star Wars prequels. But yeah, you could totally tell with his voice too, by the way, that he was not only New Zealand and not, you know, one of the other Polynesian cultures, but also that it was Temuera Morrison.
Yeah.
I mean, if you've seen and heard him before, you could tell that's who it was doing the acting.
Then you had the grandmother, Grandma Tala, who was actually played by Rachel House, and I don't remember if you saw Hunt for the Wilder People.
Nope.
Well, she's the
unfortunately, I heard it was really good.
It was really interesting. She plays the caseworker for the little boy and is the one who's going after him. And I found that out today. I'm like, oh yeah, that's her. Cool. So
which I would argue, actually, to kind of rebut one of your other, I would say the key relational dynamic in this film is between Moana and her grandmother versus her father. Her father and she and her father have differences of opinion, and so there's a certain amount of, well, then I need to prove something mm-hmm. to myself and to you and all of that. But I think that in terms of the way the story ultimately plays out, I think mm-hmm. the grandmother connection is actually very much the heartbeat of the film.
Yeah.
And makes that the Moana character's, you know, primary connecting point, I think.
It's true that obviously the grandmother does play a very large role in the progression of the story and whatnot, but it is the father's relationship with her that pretty much stops her from reaching out to learning how to sail and do those things. So it's the halting of the father's, you know, wishes for her life to that ultimately keep her from doing the things that she actually wants to do.
And her grandmother releases her to do those very things. It's interesting. The father is a representation, obviously, of the status quo of their society.
Mm-hmm.
The decision not to leave, not to sail beyond the reef, which is not very far from the island.
No.
So they basically don't have anywhere to go other than the island. And so when they can't fish anymore and there's the resources they're used to aren't there, and Moana, thinking progressively and very forward thinking, she says, well, let's just go right beyond the reef. There are probably fish right there. It's a reef. But their society generations before had decided no longer would they go beyond the reef. Mm-hmm. And the father particularly had once tried to break that rule and suffered for it. And so he's very adamant about preventing her from doing the same.
So this is ultimately the time in the first act where we are actually introduced to the older Moana, like we said, as played by Ali'i Cravalho, and this is her debut acting performance. I don't think she's done anything large scale as this, and I think she does a really great job. She's obviously I believe she's Polynesian herself.
Mm-hmm. Yep,
and She does an incredible job. I think they hit it on the head as far as choosing to cast somebody of the similar ethnicity for this role. It was kind of the same concept when they decided to cast actual Australians for the roles of the sharks in Finding Nemo.
Sure.
As opposed to somebody just mimicking.
Pretending to have an Australian accent.
Yeah. I think the idea in choosing to do so makes the film all the much more richer in its cultural, you know, dynamic.
Yeah, and they definitely won with her because she has a lot of, you know, variety in the way that she voices some of the lines. There's a lot of life to her voice. Just a lot of spirit, which is good because Moana, the character, has just a lot of spirit. She's got a lot of
spirit.
Well, I was going to say, you know, positive energy and motivational is the word I was looking for. She really is a motivational character.
Yeah.
In parts, she's motivating herself, and in other parts, she's motivating others because as the daughter of the sitting chief, she is poised to become the next chief of their tribe.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've got the well-worn, you know, Disney princess motif, however, translated in a new and different way.
It's true. And just a quick little sidebar, little tidbit. Today's actually her birthday. So,
well, happy birthday to
happy
you.
Happy birthday,
yeah. Moana.
Moana. But so as the story continues, obviously she does choose to go on, you know, her journey. And within that journey, she meets Maui. So Maui is a demigod who had stolen the heart of this island goddess. And in doing so, pretty much caused this darkness to kind of start taking over a lot of the different islands and so forth. And so,
yeah, this goddess was basically the source of all life.
Yes.
And health and fertility and all of that. And so when he took her heart, took Tafiti's heart, which is a stone with a spiral pattern on it, then her ability to continue to grant life to the entire region turns on its head, and everything starts to die.
Yeah. So Moana is charged with the journey and the mission to go and find Maui so that he can restore the heart to Tafiti. And of course, as we've stated, the rock is the voice for Maui. And I think he does a really good job. I think he really, if you hadn't have known how he looks before this, you could probably say that the voice suits the imagery for Mr. Johnson.
Oh, for real, yeah. I mean, in the preview commercials and trailers and whatever before the movie, I went in thinking, okay, I am never going to see this character of Maui because it's The Rock. It's obvious. It's very much The Rock's voice, mannerisms, all of it. Somehow they really made it work though, because watching the movie, you know that it's The Rock, and there's no way around it.
Yeah.
But they designed a character for whom the voice and the intonation and all of it actually really works pretty well.
So here's the, I guess, little trivia question so far. I don't know if you have the IMDb page up or anything, but obviously with the last couple of times that Walt Disney Animation have created films, they usually put Alan Tudyk in a specific role or in a particular role. Do you know what role he played for this film?
I do. He actually played two roles. But the main role, the featured role, Alan Tudyk is oftentimes doing voices that aren't voices, and the same is true here. He's the voice of the chicken. Hey, hey.
Hey, hey.
Or the rooster. The rooster. Pardon me.
Which director Ron Clements was quoted as saying that Hey Hey was, quote, the dumbest character in the history of Disney animation, which I think that's hilarious.
Pretty much. Really, yeah. And it's interesting because early on in the film, there's essentially a claim made. It's one of those Disney foreshadowing moments that basically is saying, well, yeah, this rooster doesn't make any sense, but you never know who might be valuable to the story, you know?
That's true.
And the rooster ends up inadvertently stowing away on the canoe that Moana ultimately leaves the island on. And I guess to a certain extent, yes, he plays an important role. He's mostly there for comic relief. The important role that he ultimately ends up doing is not something that no one else could have done, or, you know, like he doesn't have that much of a point, but, you know, he's funny. He's enjoyable to watch.
You know what I'm sad to hear, though? Is that, there was one particular individual who didn't have a role as far as a voice acting role in the film, who he usually does have a voice acting role in most of the previous Disney animation films. And that's John Ratzenberger.
Well, but he's Pixar. He does a voice in every Pixar movie, and this is not a Pixar movie.
Bummer. Wait, wasn't The Good Dinosaur Disney animation?
No, it was Pixar.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Well, then, never mind. I feel better now. So, we're obviously Moana and Maui meet, and it's almost like a brother.
Yeah, I mean,
sister.
She goes specifically to find him because the ocean chooses her when she's a toddler to be the one to restore this heart of Te Fiti. And so when she's an adolescent, she goes specifically to go find Maui, who has been banished to an island that's basically a collection of rocks for 1,000 years. And he can't leave and he can't transform because his magic fish hook that helps him to do all of his demigod power plays is missing. It's gone. Yeah. So he's just a normal guy who's been stuck on an island for 1,000 years. And so she goes off to find him and then collect his magical fish hook and take him to restore the heart of Te Fiti and set everything to rights.
Yep. And it's interesting to note that their relationship is borderline like brother-sisterly. There's immaturity. There's on his end, of course, because as everybody knows, the guy in the brother-sister relationship is always the more immature. So he's the more immature one, and she's persistent in saying, this is what we got to do. You have to listen. We got to do this. And he's like, oh, I'm going to do whatever I want, kind of do. And, you know, and then, of course, that jumps into some of the musical numbers. But
including your favorite.
Including my favorite. I have to say I'm very taken with his You're Welcome song, and it's very catchy, and I find myself humming it now at work, which is great because all my coworkers love it. They love hearing me hum the off, you know, key version of some song of a movie that they haven't been able to see yet because it doesn't come out till today. Another actual.
Well, good for them. And it's very interesting because even in the singing, it's very obviously The Rock.
Yes.
Like it's sometimes in these animated movies, they'll switch the song vocal and the speaking vocal, and they'll switch the performer, and you don't really know.
Yeah.
But it obviously The Rock did both.
And he's got talent. I got to give it to him. The man did a good job.
Well, I mean, there's some auto-tuning going on, but he did a good job.
Yeah, for a wrestler turned actor turned voice actor and everything else, I give him that. Another character that I thought was pretty interesting was Tamatoa.
Could not stand that character.
I actually enjoyed that character.
I thought that was the weakest part of the film by far.
I actually liked him because of the fact... So, Jermaine Clement, who actually voices the large... He's a large hermit crab, I guess.
Yeah, crustacean in the underworld.
He's a very egotistical hermit crab who's very self-absorbed, and he loves talking about himself because of all the gold that he has stuck to his shell and all that. Now, mind you, the reason why I like him is because, number one, obviously, he's one of the half of the comedic duo of Flight of the Conchords.
Sure.
And, you know.
I mean, that's a given.
Yeah. But secondly, he did a stint, he voiced a particular character on Rick and Morty. It's a cartoon series on mm-hmm. Adult Swim. And mind you, he gives himself the name Fart. But he's like this alien creature, whatever, but he does these really interesting songs in it, and I saw a lot of that in that, so I think that was my allure to his character in that one. He wasn't my favorite, but he was one of the
so
ones.
So you're not really
enjoyed.
Attracted to this character at all. You're attracted to the vocal performer who does two other characters that you like.
Tis true. But when I looked
both of the reasons why you said you like this had nothing to do with this character or this movie.
Well, yeah, because of the fact that yeah, it's true.
Yeah. No, yeah. I'm just pointing it out.
No, it's
they,
true.
They do actually, going back to the, you had mentioned when I was kind of doing a very quick overview of the general mythological saga.
Yeah.
Or cycle that Joseph Campbell spelled out years and years and years ago, where they descend to the underworld. In many stories, this is a figurative descent. In Moana, it's a literal descent. They actually do go into another realm of existence into the underworld, which is where they encounter this giant hermit crab creature called Tamatoa.
Tamatoa.
Who has Maui's enchanted fish hook.
Stuck at the very top of his shell. But it's at this point of the film where you've already encountered several of the musical compositions that they have, several of the songs, several of the musical numbers that Disney is known for. No matter if you're watching Frozen or if you're watching whatever film you're watching from Disney, there's usually a certain amount of musical numbers that you kind of get done with. But in this film, one of the things that was unique about the music in this film, and you kind of hit it on the head when we were talking off air, was that it somehow didn't always seem to fit with the dynamic of the film.
Yeah.
You have these incredible scenes of like islands and the indigenous people that are there and the dancing and the native language that they speak, and then you have a top hat and cane kind of song that comes on, you know, where The Rock is singing this, which, mind you, it's not a bad song, it just didn't seem to fit the bill, you
yeah
know,
it's for, there's so much in the film that feels very authentic mm-hmm. to the various different cultural expressions of the Polynesian people. The music, in many ways, is not authentic specifically to Polynesian cultures,
mm-hmm.
Pacific Islander cultures. It's more blended hip-hop and show tunes together, because you've got Lin-Manuel Miranda, who's very talented.
Yes.
And they do, they do work in some of the lyrics are actually in, I don't know if it's, you know, Hawaiian or a different Polynesian language, mm-hmm. Or Islander language, but there are authentic kind of snatches of phrasing that are worked into several of the songs. And then it transitions into English, but yeah, the overall style, the soundtrack has a very authentic sound. The songs sound more like Broadway numbers.
They do.
They don't quite integrate together. That doesn't make them bad songs. They just they don't. It's the most inauthentic feeling part of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I mean they've got a lot of work to do in terms of storytelling. A lot of the storytelling, like you see in a Broadway musical, a lot of the storytelling is done in the music itself, in the songs, in the words that are being sung. So a lot of Moana's personal journey and her transformation and acceptance of her identity and all of that kind of stuff happens in musical moments,
mm-hmm.
More so than in the lines of dialogue.
Now, mind you, we're not saying that the music is not good. That's not what we're saying, just to reiterate that, because some people will mistake in what we're saying. It's like, oh, they crapped all over the music of Moana and it was the best thing I've ever heard since, you know, Dixie sings whatever.
Yeah, I mean, by far the worst thing about this movie was that giant crab Tamatoa,
which I liked very much, but
I didn't.
Yeah, well,
although it was very colorful.
He was very colorful.
Had some
shiny,
like black light fluorescent paint action going on at one point.
Oh yeah. And so as the film progresses, you have the overall story where it's a story of redemption as well as a story of someone finding their identity as the film progresses. And we're not going to give too much away of the film because obviously this is a film that you're going to probably want to take your whole family, or you're going to want to go with someone that really enjoys Disney films, because this is in its truest form a true to form Disney film. You know, so
oh, definitely it feels, for all of its authenticity, its cultural relevance and authenticity, it definitely also is very much a Disney film.
And one thing to note, the great thing I think that this film can walk away with and still know that it did uniquely was it didn't hang on the whole princess love story style trope.
Agreed.
Now, normally, even with Frozen, people have argued and disagreed and agreed or whatever about, oh, well, you know what? Frozen was the first one where it wasn't about, you know, a princess and her prince and this and that. But there was still a princess and a prince and a love story all in all.
It was just the other sister.
Yeah, exactly. This is a film about a young princess, so to speak. So it is a princess story, but it's not the same one that you're used to. This is about a princess coming into her own and truly finding herself within the instances of the events to come and knowing who she can be.
Well, and a lot of the climactic moment of the film, because of the way that things happen between her and some of the other characters, she has to take it upon her own self to solve the problem of the story, to restore this, you know, Heart of Tefiti and all of that. And she's the one that figures it out. She has a little bit of help eventually, but going into it, she doesn't know that she's going to have any help. She decides to do it by herself and is the one who ultimately solves the problem.
It's true.
In a fairly unique way. I mean, I think for a lot of younger audience members, it's going to feel very unique,
mm-hmm.
the way the problem is solved, like how certain elements of the story tie together and connect when you thought that they were one thing, they turn out to be something different.
Yeah.
I think for a lot of, you know, kids in the audience, we had a lot of kids in the preview screening that we went to. There were a lot of kids in the audience, and there was just raucous applause at the end of it. I think that it was genuinely entertaining, surprising, and meaningful for the audience that, you know, Disney makes all of its movies for.
Yeah. So with all that said, of course, like I said, we're not going to reveal the ending, but we are going to say, you know, it was a very interesting film, and it was, you know, something that we rather enjoyed. We didn't walk out saying, gosh, I'm glad we didn't pay for that kind of deal. We actually had a good time seeing the film. So with that said, Chad, does it pass or fail, and how many monocles?
It does pass. I think that not being the target audience for the movie, because
mm-hmm.
I'm a little bit older than the target audience
really?
For the movie. I know, it's a surprise. Some days I can't tell the difference between myself and a child, but I'm not their audience. I would give it still, though, a very, very solid 3.5
mm-hmm.
out of 5. I could have used more of the coconut people because they're not in it for very long, but they're pretty funny.
They are.
Honestly, I could have used a little bit more of Minnie Maui. who is one of the tattoos, who I really enjoyed. But I thought it was very competent, a very meaningful, emotionally rich movie. And I really enjoyed how colorful it was.
Same here. I have to give it, it does pass for me as well as a 3.5, based simply on the fact that it does hit all the marks for your standard Disney film, and it, but it delivers it in a slightly different package as far as the princess trope and what people are going to define now from here on out as far as what is considered a Disney princess, and I can appreciate that. The music didn't really fit certain parts, and that's where it kind of wavered for me. But the overall visuals of the film, the overall cinematography as far as what they created for each scene was splendid. I give it a solid 3.5.
Definitely. And I think, you know, it just, as with so many, movie is, as much as movies tell niche stories, they tell stories within a certain genre. There's a certain requirement that it resonates with a modern audience. And I would say one of the things that really surprised me about this one is that for all of its kind of older time period setting, it had a very contemporary feel.
It's the final countdown.
Yeah, it's true. So, you know what? But that does lead us right into our special segment, which is... That's right, ladies and gentlemen. We are bringing back
the final countdown.
So, you know what? We haven't done it in a while, but you know what? We had such a good time with Moana, and no, many other moviegoers will also have fun. But let's have a bit more fun and festiveness as we decide to dish up some good old final countdowns.
I like what you did there.
Thank you.
Dish up since it's Thanksgiving tomorrow.
And in this holiday edition, we're going to take some inspiration from the film and take time to show how thankful we are as we reminisce on our top three favorite animated films. So, Chad doesn't really... I kind of sprung this on him today, and he was still trying to get stuff taken care of before. So, I'm good either way, but I want to put the ball in your court, sir. Number three, top computer animated films.
You know, you always do this to me because you're the one who asks the questions. So you're always the one who goes second.
I can go first if you like.
No, I'm totally fine.
Then
top
I'd probably
computer
take
animated film. I don't know if you will. My favorite computer animated film to date is still WALL-E.
Ah, it's true.
Love that movie.
Right.
I loved not only how unique certain elements of the story are, but the way that the story is told, because it's not a character who sits there and yabbers on. It's told through look and sound.
Yeah.
In many ways. The character design and making the expressiveness needing to non-verbally communicate so much of what you normally would have the character just come out and say, I thought was genius.
Yeah. For mine, I'm glad you didn't say mine because I was really hoping. I was like, I actually have to go with Wreck-It Ralph. I love John C. Reilly's characterization of Ralph himself, and I love the way the film... I just love the overall story of that film. Not to mention, I like video games, so you incorporate video games into a film like that and a kid's film, and you have a smash hit in my book. So,
definitely.
Number two, top non-Disney animated film.
Why don't you go first? Because I haven't thought
Certainly.
Of mine yet.
I would have to go with non-Disney. I would have to go with The Secret of Nim. Mid to late 80s film, not Disney. Because around that same time is when Black Cauldron came out, and Black Cauldron was the last time that Disney kind of was doing that style of animation until
right. Then they went on hiatus a little bit, and they came out with
Little Mermaid,
which, you know, back on the full Broadway musical in animated form.
Tis true, but I'm a huge fan of The Secret of Nim. I like the idea of the story. The story is about this woman whose husband goes missing. She's wondering where he is. There's this huge conspiracy going on amidst the leaders of the rats and the mice, and then the farmer who owns the entire place is going to pretty much tear out the entire property and they're going to be up in ruins. It's there's a lot of storyline and depth to this animated film for it being a cartoon. And yeah, I have to say it was between that and The Land Before Time. So,
See, The Land Before Time would have been a great one for me to think about because I loved dinosaurs. I loved The Land Before Time as a kid. I like wore out the VHS tape
of The Land Before
Time. Yeah. Although it was, you know, incredibly sad. So that actually should be my top one, but the one that I thought of, the one that came to mind, was the other VHS tape that I wore out as a kid, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which does have Disney characters in it, but as far as I recall, is not a Disney film, and it's a blend of live action and animation.
I guess I'll give you that one.
I mean, they partnered. They had, you know, Warner characters. Brothers, yeah. They had all the Looney Tunes and whatnot. They had Disney characters. They
that
had
was
other,
really interesting.
You know, made-up characters. Roger Rabbit and Jessica Rabbit. They're, you know, don't exist in either of those pantheons. You know, they're made up for that movie. So, The Taxi.
Yeah.
Looking back on it, I'm surprised that I liked it as much as I did because it's actually quite disturbing in some parts.
I'm like, it's actually quite.
Yeah,
dark
like it's
film.
It's really, really surprisingly disturbing looking at it as an adult. But as a kid, I thought it was great.
Yeah. All right. Well, that brings us to our number one spot, which is the overall favorite animated film.
This one's easy for me.
Go ahead, Sir Chad.
I completely, to this day, completely love Aladdin. I think that Robin Williams as the genie was one of the funnest defining moments of childhood in the history of time that anybody could have, and I got to have that as a kid.
Yeah.
As did you.
Aye.
So, well, yeah, Aladdin.
You stole mine.
Not the sequels, though. They weren't as good, but
now,
the original Aladdin,
okay, but the
super great.
The second one was kind of...
The magic carpet. Really, in talking about Moana, one of the characters I really enjoyed a lot was the ocean.
Yes.
Because the ocean is a character in the film and reminded me a lot of the magic carpet Aladdin.
Actually,
I mean, the way that the ocean interacts with the human characters, I guess you could say, reminded me a lot of the way that the carpet interacted with Aladdin and Jasmine and Abu the monkey and, you know, all that.
That's true. I didn't even think about that. I mean, because I spent much of the time while we were watching Moana trying to find the little Easter eggs and things like that I actually overlooked the biggest one, which is that one. But all right. Well, I just really quick off the top of my head, since you took mine, because I love Aladdin.
That's okay. You can take The Lion King.
I was going to say the Lion King. I know. Just for the simple fact that, I mean, it's the animated version of Hamlet. I mean, how can you go wrong with that?
It was extraordinary.
It was extremely extraordinary for a film to have that type of story development and that type of plots in a cartoon film to serve your child. Hey, by the way, in this film, the dad's gonna die and the little boy's gonna have to run off and grow up by himself. I mean, you try feeding that to anybody nowadays, any children, and they'll be picket lines in front of the theater, like they're trying to brainwash your kids and kind of stuff.
I don't know. They're turning it into a live action movie. Rumor has it.
That's true. And they'll probably kind of muddy the waters a bit when it comes to certain things here and there. But all in all, obviously, Aladdin was my first choice, but I'll go with my next best, which is The Lion King. Well, that about wraps up another great show of the Filmlosophers. Remember, if you want to connect with us, go ahead and drop us a link or drop us a word on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Filmlosophers or on our Twitter page at twitter.com/Filmlosophy101. This was a great conversation, and you know what? If you get a chance and during this holiday week, by all means, go and try to check out the film. It's a good film, and you'll enjoy it. But to leave you with a little bit of Disney wisdom, as quoted by the lovely Stitch from Lilo and Stitch, keep this in mind for your holidays. Ohana means family. Family means...
Nobody gets left behind.
That's right. Or...
Or forgotten.
That's right. So
now, technically, it was Lilo who said it first, but Stitch does eventually say...
And that's where it really matters.
Yeah.
So with this Thanksgiving week and this Thanksgiving season, have fun with your families. Have a great time. Watch some awesome movies. And you know what?
And catch up on old episodes of the Filmlosophers, because
exactly.
There's a bunch of them now.
There are. You know what? There's like 38, I think. We're up there.
We're getting up there in age, man.
Yeah. But like I said, it was a great show. It was a great conversation. It's always fun chatting with Chad. And yeah. So from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
class dismissed.
And happy Thanksgiving.